It's Super Tuesday crunch time.
And an appropriate time to point out the drawbacks of super PACs.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, March 6th.
Coming up, we'll check in on the recovery in the aftermath of those deadly tornadoes.
They're recreating a big event in the struggle for civil rights.
And who dat in trouble with the National Football League.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today is Super Tuesday, the biggest day so far in the race for the Republican presidential nomination. 10 states will hold primaries or caucuses. But in some of those states, not every candidate will be on the ballot due to a lack of organization. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, campaign organization is one thing super PAC spending can't help with.
In Virginia, neither Newt Gingrich nor Rick Santorum could gather the signatures needed to appear on today's primary ballot. Santorum won't be on ballots in 3 of Ohio's districts, putting 9 of Ohio's 66 delegates automatically out of his reach. Even though the super PACs supporting these two candidates are flush with cash, some campaign tasks are off limits.
Because super PACs can't coordinate with the candidate, clearly they can't go about getting the signatures to get the candidate on the ballot or finding delegates.
Bradley Smith is a former Federal Election Commission chairman, now a professor at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio.
We find that super PACs are pretty good on the media end, but they don't help you get that ground game of volunteers together that is so important, especially at the primary stage.
It's a lesson Republican frontrunner Mitt Romney has taken to heart. He's reaching out for more direct contributions from smaller donors. So far, less than 10% of his campaign funds have come from donations of $200 or less. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
They're mourning loved ones and assessing damage across the Midwest and South this week in the aftermath of as many as 80 tornadoes that left 40 people dead. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been checking in on the recovery. Mitchell, you have to wonder, how do they even start picking up the pieces from such total devastation in some of those communities?
Well, Bob, what's happening now, in addition to sheltering people and caring for the injured, is assessing the economic losses. Now, that breaks down roughly to homes. They're going to need to be repaired. In some cases, you know, there'll probably be a total loss and they'll have to be rebuilt. Cars wrecked from the wind and the flying debris, and businesses unable to reopen. We asked Matthew Nielsen of Risk Management Solutions how this start to the 2012 tornado season compares to last year. You'll remember that there were those huge tornadoes that hit Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and also Joplin, Missouri.
Certainly, this was a very bad event for some small towns. It's not looking like it's anything near what we saw last year yet with the Alabama outbreak, a $7.3 billion insured event, or even the Joplin, which was $6.9 billion. Most likely, this will be more down towards the $1 to $2 billion range.
Now, how do they figure this out so quickly after the storm, said Mitchell?
Well, Nielsen told us that the insurance industry sends out people called catastrophe risk modelers right after the storms. And what they do basically is compare maps of where there was residential and commercial building to the actual path and wind strength of the tornadoes. The goal is to try to figure out roughly how much dollar value was lost. And of course, these small towns are just beginning to deal with the human cost of these storms.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it is not all bad news when it comes to the weather, Bob. We've taken note in recent days here at Marketplace of how the unusually mild winter in much of the country has given the economy a boost. Well, now there's word of another benefit. Data from the airline tracking firm FlightStats shows on-time arrival rates are up across the country. In fact, 8 airlines had on-time rates of around 90% last month.
You know, you just know they're going to figure out a way to make money on this. I'm not going to be surprised.
An on-time fee.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Did China just sneeze on the global economy? Investors got the shivers yesterday when Beijing forecast cooling economic temperatures, but our China correspondent Rob Schmitz found decidedly less concern.
Across the developed world, headlines spelled out economic doom. Is China's role as global growth engine over? One of them asked. Analyst Andrew Batson works at Gavakkal Draganomics in Beijing.
I think having a slightly slower rate of GDP growth actually addresses a lot of the issues that people are worried about.
Issues like why is the government investing so much in building stuff when Chinese people, compared with those in the developed world, aren't buying much? China's central planners have modified their growth predictions for China's economy to 7.5% this year. They hope this will rebalance the economy and give more people here the opportunity to buy more stuff. Batson says it won't be easy. The concern is if growth in investment begins to slow down, it could be a huge shock not only to China's economy, but to the global economy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
It's not just China we have to worry about. There is plenty that could derail our own economic rebound on the Middle Eastern horizon. And by that, we mean energy prices. Julie Niemann is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company who focuses on the oil market. She's with us now from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about that's driven oil prices up and gas prices up as well has been concern about tension with Iran. And I want to play you something that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in Washington last night, talking about the steps that have to be taken to deal with Iran's nuclear program.
We've waited for diplomacy to work. We've waited for sanctions to work. None of us can afford to wait much longer.
Now, Julie, it does sound like tensions are rising even further between Israel and Iran, between the U.S. and Iran. What are the oil markets saying about all this?
Well, we oil analysts are looking at it rationally. Iran and Israel explosion would have too much to lose. Iran needs the oil trade money with China and India. They won't bomb their own Straits of Hormuz just for spider to prove a point. And Israel won't bomb them because the Iranian citizens are already pushing for change and there are no nuclear warheads imminent. If they were attacked from the outside, this would simply entrench everything further. But what rational people would say and conclude, too much to lose. But we've seen in the past, war is seldom rational, and the markets are bracing for the irrational.
The markets are bracing for the irrational. How would that trickle down to our economy? What would that mean for us and for gas prices and the recovery that's going on here?
Oh, no trickle down. It'll be a tsunami. $150 a barrel overnight. You're going to see gasoline spike to $5 a barrel. And you're going to look at growth and recovery in the economy, which is very fragile at the moment, come to a screeching halt. Just when it looks like housing is no longer a real drag on the economy and employment is improving, this would bring everything to a temporary halt.
Well, Julie, let me just get your thoughts on that before we let you go. Employment, you say, is improving. What are you expecting Friday? We're going to get the big monthly jobs report from the government. What's the unemployment rate going to do? Keep going down?
Well, you're looking at employment coming from small and medium businesses and mostly in non-manufacturing. This is a real positive. It should continue to rise at a rate of around 200,000 a month. And I think Friday's employment report right now is still on track. But like I say, it's a confidence situation here that could turn on a dime as well.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, as long as we're ticking down the sources of concern, Jeremy, you might as well add Europe's troubles to this mix.
That's right. Greece has been at the center of the European debt crisis recently, but it's worth remembering that Ireland is also trying to climb out of debt trouble after being bailed out back in 2010. When that bailout happened, we spoke with Father Iggy O'Donovan, the parish priest in the town of Drogheda, and we are happy to welcome him back right now. Good morning, Father.
Good morning.
Well, last time we talked, here is what you said.
We had a mighty party. We have the mother of all hangovers now.
So have you gotten over the hangover in Ireland yet?
I still think we've got a touch of the hangover. You see, your listeners must appreciate that Ireland came through probably about 15 years of what was called the Celtic Tiger. So we came from an almighty party, if you like. The thing came to a shuddering halt. But things have smoothened out a little. Of course, since we spoke, our friends from the IMF and the European Central Bank and others have arrived. And in effect, Ireland is now being run from Berlin.
And when you say the Celtic Tiger, you're talking about the big boom that Ireland experienced.
Yeah, that was the expression that was coined for the Celtic Tiger. Nowadays, we are talking more about the Celtic snail.
Now, Ireland has had to go through a lot of what are called austerity measures, big time budget cuts and tax increases. What's that been like for the people who live there?
It's been tough. The ECB has arrived. The IMF have arrived. And they have simply been all over the place, swinging budget cuts, cutbacks in all the major spending departments, particularly in the fields of social welfare, education, health. So very, very many people are feeling the pain.
Ireland is a couple of years ahead of Greece on the bailout train, if you will. Do you think that you're a model? Do you think that Ireland has done what needs to be done to sort of move forward, or have you made the wrong decisions?
Well, many people are pointing out that as far as the ECB and the IMF are concerned, we're the good boys in the class. We have done what we were told. Like you will have noticed on your TV screens, the Greeks took to the streets. The best the Irish did was that they kicked out the government. In many ways, maybe it's part of the strength of our democracy that most people were happy to leave it at that. And there hasn't been literally any social unrest or problems of that sort.
Do you wish you weren't in the euro? Do you think it would have been easier if you had just left the euro?
We would have had much more control over our affairs. For example, because of the policies followed by the European Central Bank, cheap money became available in a massive way from the Germans and the French, who were disciplined themselves, but they gave it. If you like, they threw the whiskey at the alcoholics. And by God, did we drink it.
You know, your sermons must be fantastic.
Well, I'd like to think so, but I also like to look at the bright side. It has been a massive surgical operation carried out on a patient who thought he was in good health. But while we're in the intensive care unit, I think we may be just about off life support.
Just about off life support. So what would be your advice to other countries in Europe, and there are many of them, who may have to go through the same kind of thing?
I think it's necessary to use an expression to take the bull by the horns and to go through this period of pain, because I think it's a question of no pain, no gain. Other people are not going to bail us out now. We've got to earn it ourselves. The only way we'll survive is create growth in the economy.
Father Iggy O'Donovan is our man in Ireland, joining us from Drogheda today. Thanks so much.
God bless. Thank you very much.
Figures out of the Goethe Institute in Germany show that the number of Spaniards, Italians, and other Europeans looking to learn German were way up last year, Bob. In Spain alone, the figures rose 35%. It seems as though this is perhaps linked to the desire to get a job in some of the more well-to-do countries in Europe, or maybe it's just because the whole continent is being run from Berlin right now. For our Midday Extra, we're going to explore this with Michael Geisler. He's vice president of the language schools and schools abroad at Middlebury College. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is going on here with all these people in Europe wanting to learn German?
Well, obviously, as you pointed out, the recent successes of Germany are a strong incentive. And even as Germans are being vilified for their fiscal conservatism across the European Union, people are voting with their feet and are signing up for the language.
Well, no pun intended here, but have we noticed in the past such a pronounced shift in these language trends?
Yes, there have always been shifts in language trends. I mean, we see that here at the Middlebury Summer Language Schools, where in Arabic, for instance, we had in the 50s in 1989 and through the too much of the 1990s that rose to about 80 or so. Then, as you can imagine, after 9/11, but also for economic reasons, the interest in Arabic has just exploded to the point where we now have 170, 185 students actually studying Arabic. Similarly, in Chinese, we had about 90 students or so in the mid-90s, and we now have 170, including graduate students in Chinese. So that's obviously driven by economic interests.
How are we doing in this country when it comes to languages right now? Are Americans, as you say, in big numbers, learning Arabic and Chinese and these languages that are going to be important in the coming decades?
In growing numbers, but not enough. And it's not just Arabic and Chinese. It's all the major world languages that we need a lot more. You know that about 18% of Americans are bilingual or trilingual or speak several languages, versus around 50% in the European Union. And in his 1980 book, then-Senator Paul Simon estimated that we were losing 200,000 jobs each year because of lack of foreign language skills. And that was before the fall of the Berlin Wall, before the rise of the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and before the internet gained the prominence that it has today, and before we had the recent wave of globalization efforts. So if you factor that in, we've fallen further behind since then.
What I hear you saying is that we're always behind with this stuff, huh?
Well, we caught up a little bit after the Sputnik crisis in the sciences, and we were looking a little better in the 70s and 80s. But yes, we've fallen behind again lately. And in an internationally competitive global society, we really can't afford that. We are now losing jobs. people are looking for jobs in international corporations, and almost reflexively these jobs go to Europeans who are multilingual, who speak English, but also French or German or Portuguese or Russian, and not to Americans, because the reigning assumption is that Americans don't know these languages. So with equal qualifications on the side of many American students, we are actually losing jobs to people from other nations who are multilingual.
Well, Michael Geisler at Middlebury College, danke schön, and thank you very much.
Bitte. Thank you very much.
Time for a quick history lesson now. Let's go back 100 years, Bob, exactly. March 6th, 1912. At that time, we're talking about Super Tuesday today. Back then, Ohio actually had more people than California and Florida combined.
Ah, the good old days. Not that I remember it.
Well, also, we just heard about Ireland. Ireland at that time in 1912 was very excited about having just built the Titanic, which was about to set sail. Mm-hmm. Also, we just heard about Iranian oil. Well, oil in Iran was discovered just 4 years earlier than 1912 in 1908.
You are just a font of information, aren't you?
Now, here's the best part.
Okay.
Here in this country, March 6, 1912, the National Biscuit Company, Nabisco, unveiled the Oreo cookie.
Oh, now you're talking.
There we go. And last year, Oreo sales worldwide hit $2 billion.
The New Orleans Saints have a lot more questions to answer than just who dat. Former Saints defensive coordinator Greg Williams was questioned by league investigators yesterday. He's apologized for an allegedly illegal bounty system which rewarded players for injuring opponents. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith.
For getting someone carted off the field, New Orleans Saints players were apparently paid $1,000. Knocking a player out of the game? $1,500. Still, sports economist Andy Zimbalist says the real incentive probably wasn't money. After all, the average NFL player makes more than $1 million a year.
It's the players who want more recognition, player who's still trying to make it, who is going to be more susceptible to this kind of an environment.
The punishment from the NFL could involve hefty fines and suspensions, but the fallout from the bounty scandal could backfire in other ways, says sports analyst Matt Powell. He says endorsements and merchandise sales rely heavily on fans feeling good about a team.
And this may move some fan sentiment in the opposite direction. So this could end up hurting some teams in the pocketbook in terms of licensed product sales and maybe even ticket sales.
Powell says football fans usually don't mind a little unnecessary roughness, but this scandal may have crossed the line. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
This week, civil rights activists in Alabama are on a trek from Selma to Montgomery. A march along that same route in 1965 helped bring about the Voting Rights Act. This time, activists are protesting what they see as the erosion of that law and promoting Latino rights. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
The march began in Selma on Sunday. The mostly African-American crowd protested state voter ID laws they say could keep some black voters from the polls. But marchers were also critical of Alabama's tough new immigration law. Janet Murguia was one of the Latinas in the crowd. She's president of the National Council of La Raza.
The attacks on voter rights and the attacks on immigration rights have really brought our communities together.
In the past, some economic issues have divided the two groups. Marching beside Murguia was Emmanuel Cleaver, chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus.
There is an issue of economic competition between African Americans and Latinos, particularly at entry-level jobs in the country.
Still, he says it's in the self-interest of African Americans to level the playing field for all workers in this country. He supports giving undocumented Latinos some kind of legal status.
And they would have to be paid minimum wage. And so African Americans actually come out better the better Latinos are treated.
As far as competition between blacks and Latinos, some academics say the research shows little impact. Professor Douglas Massey follows immigration at Princeton University. He says that immigration in Los Angeles actually helped African-American employment.
The massive increase in the Latino population created strong demand for public services and boosted African-American employment in the public sector, where they had a strong comparative advantage, being native English speakers and being citizens by birth.
African-American workers were able to move up.
There was a shift of black workers out of unskilled, low-wage jobs and upgrading into public sector jobs with higher pay and benefits.
In Alabama, more Latino faces will join the march this week. It will finish in Montgomery with a call to end the state's immigration laws. Expect to hear more songs like this. Si se puede, Spanish for yes we can. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A couple of British men have been charged with hacking into computers at Sony Music and stealing a large number of song files, reportedly including numerous unreleased Michael Jackson tracks. Shortly after his death, Sony paid $250 million to Jackson's estate for the planned release of his back catalog and a trove of unreleased material.
You know, Bob, you'd think with names like Beat It and Leave Me Alone, they might have gotten the message. Apparently
indeed.
Not.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.